This is Apologetics Profile, a podcast ministry of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated, Arlington, Texas, helping and equipping you to better understand the world of non-Christian ideas and religions, one conversation at a time. Here's your host, staff apologist Daniel Ray.
The General Social Survey, or GSS, was launched April 19, 1972, just a day before Apollo 16 astronauts Charlie Duke and John Young landed on the moon. The GSS began as an independent research project of the National Opinion Research Center, or NORC, founded in 1941 at the University of Chicago. You may be unfamiliar with the GSS or just how influential the survey has become in forming our cultural understanding of religious beliefs and practices in the United States. So, what exactly is the General Social Survey? What are the questions it asks? How is it conducted, and why is so much attention given to it? As the GSS website notes, quote, "The General Social Survey, or GSS, is NORC's longest-running project and one of its most influential. GSS data are frequently used in newspaper, magazine, and journal articles, and by legislators, policymakers, and educators. The GSS also serves as a major teaching tool in colleges and universities. More than 32,500 journal articles, books, and PhD dissertations are based on GSS data. And approximately 400,000 students use the GSS in their classes each year," end quote. Like it or not, the influence of the GSS is long-reaching and continues to have a significant impact upon our collective cultural understanding of the beliefs and behaviors of believers and non-believers alike in the United States. If you are one who is interested in what surveys tell us about the state of belief in America today, you don't want to miss these next two episodes of The Profile. I recently discovered a 2021 book by Ryan Burge called The Nuns, Where They Came From, Who They Are, and Where They Are Going. I found out about it through a local Dallas-Fort Worth atheist book club to which I had been invited. The Nuns was their featured book of the month for March. I was the lone Christian among 12 to 15 non-believers. We had dinner and an enjoyable and civil discussion. I reached out to Ryan, and he graciously agreed to be our guest this week and next on Apologetics Profile. Ryan is a Baptist pastor and assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He is a leading expert and consultant about the data produced by the GSS. He has appeared on a number of media outlets as a guest, including 60 Minutes, who calls Ryan, quote, "one of the country's leading data analysts on religion and politics," end quote. Ryan's articles have appeared in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal.
I mean, I love getting in the weeds of social science. I think a lot of people are, they have questions about how surveys work. They don't want to feel stupid by asking them. And so I love those. I think that Americans are data illiterate, and I think that everything I can do to help them become more data literate is a service, not just to me, but to like the larger social science community. I love those kind of questions. I love discussion about data and polling and all that stuff, because I think it's everyone thinks about it one way. It affects everyone of our lives, and I'm an expert in that area. So I kind of want to, you know, help educate the public about what I know about. I tell people, I go, listen, my job is not to tell you how I wish the world would be or hope it would be. I'm telling you how it is. And whether it makes you good, you know, happy, sad, indifferent, it honestly is irrelevant to me. My job is to be as neutral as arbiter as I can, and then let you, and that's great too, is it allows me to not get caught up in all the Twitter wars, because I don't have an opinion. You know, like, here's what the data says. And if it makes you mad, then you tweet about it and you make a thread and you start a fight. But I'm not part of that fight. That's you as part of that fight. So I like that. I like that role, because I don't want to fight. I don't find a lot of joy in the flame wars on social media. I'd rather just put out data and say, okay, this sparks a conversation. That's fantastic. But I am not going to be hot take central. That ain't my job.
Here on part one, Ryan and I talk about the General Social Survey, what it is, how it has been conducted, and what the data it produces tells us about the religious and political landscape in the U.S. today. Ryan also shares with us how his book had its genesis in a single post on Twitter. that included a chart about the data from the GSS regarding the rise of the nuns. As we begin part one, Ryan asks me about what my atheist and skeptic dinner companions thought of the book. Here is Ryan Burge.
Yeah, tell me how they react. I'm really interested. Atheist, I'll just give you what I've been told the last, 2 years about the book. And that is that they think, some of them at least, think that it is a subtle piece of propaganda to try to help Christians make nuns into Christians. Like it's an evangelistic track in some weird way.
Hmm. Well, that did come up, Ryan. A few people had thought, some of the club members were unaware that you were a pastor and had a Christian background. And so that did come up. But other people thought that you did, given your what they assumed to be your Christian bias, they thought you did a fair approach as best you could and anticipated that, given that you are a pastor, that inevitably that this would come back around to this being... one person objected to this being good news that people were leaving religion. But there was kind of, from what I could tell from listening, there was kind of a balance between, yeah, he's a Christian pastor and this is just sort of a more formal evangelistic track. And no, he's really trying to do the best to set aside his bias and really look at the data. So it was kind of, from what I felt, it was kind of maybe split a little bit, but I think the individual who chose it, I think he knew that you were a pastor and chose the book anyway. Because
can I just say that like gives me great joy because like that's like the primary critique of that book is it's too much of one and not enough. It depends on what your perspective is.
Right.
Right. Like if you're like an evangelical, the critique that I get from evangelicals is I wish you would have given me more practical advice about how to win the nuns back to church. And the atheist folks are the exact opposite of that.
Right.
They think that I should sort of strip all that stuff out and make it just straight social science. And so just a spoiler alert, there's a second edition of that book coming out in about 2 months. And in the foreword, I sort of address that tension between those two poles, you know, my two identities as a social scientist and as a pastor. And I refuse to pick a side. I think I did more of both. In the second edition of the book. I think that's actually the true, and it sold relatively well for a book from a first-time author from a smaller publisher. I mean, it's done well, and I think it's done well for exactly the audience that read it, which is a lot of evangelicals read it because they wanted some good statistics on the religiously unaffiliated. But I also think atheists read it because they wanted to understand themselves better at the same time. So I think that's why the book, you know, from just a pure marketing perspective, if you go for a niche, you better like sell that book to everyone in that subgroup.
Mm-hmm.
But if you try to go across several different segments in the market, you don't have to sell it to everyone. You sell it to 10% of a huge swath of, you know, the reading public. You're going to do a lot better than just trying to sell it to 5% of the public, but try to sell it to all of them. And so, you know, if I write another edition of that book again, I'm going to do the exact same thing. I've got no desire to be pigeonholed as like an evangelical social scientist or a non-religious social scientist, to be honest with you. I think living in both worlds is actually sort of my unfair advantage compared to other social science.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you in a small way, you kind of mirror the mystery of the incarnation, fully God, fully man existing with us. You know, you embody two worlds that just don't seem to go together, science and religion, if you will. But I thought we'd begin, Ryan, with the story of how this book seemed to have begun in a great place to begin for Christians in the beginning, right? Talk about the tweet that you never expected to go viral. This was a fascinating story. How did this all get started?
So I was a little known tweeter. I had an account that maybe had 600 or 700 followers. I was tweeting out graphs about religion here and there. Kind of, it was actually a way for me to show off some sort of data analysis and visualization skills that I was working on behind the scenes and try to get some feedback and just try to be part of the conversation. And so in 2019, the General Social Survey had just released its 2018 data, which is a big day for social science because we get to learn how things changed over the last couple of years. And so The graph that I wanted to make was just showing what American religion looks like over the last, from 1972 to 2018. And so I tweet this graph out in between. My kids were little at the time. They were like 6 and 4. And so, you know, I had them in the bath and I was, you know, getting them ready for bed and getting pajamas on and reading them a book. And I was tweeting, I was like making this graph and trying to make it look as best I can, but also knowing that there was some big news here. And so I tweeted this graph out where I basically said, you know, now the nuns are larger than any other religious group. And I hit the tweet button and I walked away and I went upstairs and I read my kid a book and I looked down at my phone after reading him a book and it's already, you know, been retweeted like 10 or 12 times, which now I know, being on the other side of that, that's a good indication that it's going to go viral. It needs to go quick. And that one went quick. And so I woke up the next morning, had a couple hundred retweets. By the end of 24 hours, it'd been retweeted several hundred times. And then over the course of that tweet, it kept going and going and going. And then all of a sudden, like Sam Harris would retweet it, who was a big atheist. And it was just like one thing after another. And then CNN called, New York Times called, Washington Post called, Times of London called, New York Post. I mean, everyone on earth wanted to talk about this idea of the nuns rising. And for whatever reason, I became like the spokesperson for social science when it comes to religion.
Right.
And that is really what led me to where I'm at today. Like establishing those relationships with reporters back then, I talked to those same reporters today. And that led my Twitter account to get a lot more followers, which if you keep putting out content that's good, your followers will continue to increase. So over the last 3 or 4 years, I just keep putting out more and more graphs on Twitter of stuff I'm thinking about, stuff I'm analyzing for book chapters or book ideas or whatever it is. And I'll get, you know, now I've had, I mean, it's hard to go a week now where I don't have a tweet that gets retweeted 100 times. So it just sort of mushrooms on itself and becomes exponential growth. And then whenever a publisher comes to me in 2019 and says, you have any book ideas? I go, yeah, this tweet went viral about the nuns. Why not write about what people are already interested in? Mm. So I use that one graph as basically saying like, I've got all this other data on the nuns. I could do like a full book length explication of what the nuns look like and how they're changing over time. And that's kind of the seed idea of the book. And that's what started really my career as a public academic.
Wow, that is that's phenomenal, right? What a story. You know, Twitter is not all bad, I think.
I go on a whole rant with my students. I go, listen, social media, I think on balance, the way most of you use it is bad. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the way most people use social media is a bad thing. But if you think about my background, I come from a town of 8,000 people in rural Southern Illinois. I went to a high school with 180 kids. I was not the best student in my high school. I went to Greenville University, I graduated with 160 kids in Greenville University. I went to SIU Carbondale for my PhD, which is not the most prestigious institute. It ain't Harvard. Okay. And then I teach at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston, Illinois, in the middle of literal nowhere. Hmm. I would have never in the old days, 10, 15 years ago, I would have never been where I'm at today without social media. And I say that without a sense of irony and out of a sense of exaggeration at all. I did not follow the traditional track to get where I'm at. Mm. And I use social media as my platform. And I think social media is great because the cream rises on social media. There's no gatekeepers on social media, which is also the worst part about it too. But in my case, really benefited me in my career because people, if you put out good content, people will find you. And that's exactly what's been happening with me over the last 5 years or so.
Mm. Well, it's, I have a similar story, not quite as dramatic, but I have a book too, The Story of the Cosmos, that by and large happened kind of in some sense through social media, but it certainly grew through social media. And it was social media, it was Twitter, in fact, that the book is about the cosmos. And so through Twitter, I made contact with Carl Sagan's daughter, Sasha. And I was like, this is amazing. And Sasha and I, she had put out a book just a little bit after ours came out. And so we exchanged books with each other. I sent her a copy of my book. And we actually had a nice interview. She agreed to talk with our atheist and Christian book club. And it was delightful. So, you know, I affirm that there can be absolutely good uses of social media for this kind of thing. So congratulations on your rise to graphic data stardom, if you will, Ryan. That's a fantastic story.
Yes. But then there's pressure, though, right?
There's pressure. It's like the music industry. You're one hit one. Are you going to be a one hit wonder? Is your follow up going to be just as inviting? Let's talk about, though, because this is, as you say, you found yourself in the spotlight. How come I become the spokesperson here? But really the data from which you're drawing from, I'd like to familiarize our audience with this, because the entity that put this out and excites the social media or the social sciences, social scientists, is the General Social Survey. Is that correct? The GSS?
That's right.
And it comes out of the University of Chicago. Tell us a little bit about
right.
What is this thing?
Yeah. So it's actually funded by your tax dollar. So thank you all for doing that. I appreciate that. The National Science Foundation has been funding it since 1972. It is considered to be the gold standard survey in social science because it's been done the same way with the same questions for almost 50 years now. And the National Opinion Research Council is the one that administers it. They have a whole staff that spends, years and years. Like they have, five or six people who spend their entire career trying to get the best data possible and then giving it all away, putting it on their website, making it freely available for download. And that's, I live in the world of free open access data. I mean, that is, the Nuns is entirely on data that you could go download right now and analyze yourself. This isn't something I'm doing. Surveys are expensive. I don't think people realize that. Like doing a good survey, the way that they do it is incredibly, we're talking millions of dollars to do the surveys they do. And even for me to do a survey on the side, it's probably just to do 1,000 people, a general pop survey is probably $5,000. So this is a very expensive job, but they make it easy for me because they make the data easily accessible. I just download it and I do my analysis. And so that's what's great about my book is I can say, if you don't trust me, go do it yourself. Like this data doesn't belong to me. It belongs to all of us. So everything in the book is replicable and I'm more than happy to share my computer code with people if they want to, replicate it. But I want to talk about just for a second, the GSS. What an amazing resource. Like if you want to track how things have changed in America over the last 50 years, there is not a better source than the General Social Survey. And I can't tell you how many academics have built their entire careers on the General Social Survey and the stuff they publish. I mean, it is the backbone of what we do as social scientists, especially of those who study religion like myself. There's not a better data source on the planet,
it's been around from what I've read in your book. Early 1970s, 1972, I believe. Mm-hmm. Is that?
That's right.
That's how it got started.
50 years of data now we almost have. It's unbelievable to think. I mean, there are academics who literally live their entire career under the GSS, and there's going to be a second generation of those academics now. I mean, it is unbelievable to think how many careers have been built and tenured and promoted and all those things off the GSS. So it's an unbelievable resource that I think, the average American, I think, spends 10 cents on it, and that 10 cents has been returned to them many, many fold by what we learn about America and how we've changed over the last 50 years.
So it begins in the era of the Jesus movement, if you will, in the 1970s, late 1960s, early 1970s. I imagine that some of the inspiration for starting this survey was to take a more vested interest, I guess, for lack of a better term, scientifically, in what was going on culturally with religion. Is that accurate to say?
It was a movement. God bless, all these guys are dead, by the way, who started the GSS. Like they were all, this has been 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. We were moving, and there's a big shift in social science. The quantitative revolution really started in the last 30 years or so, but it started because these guys started collecting survey data. If you look back at social science 100 years ago, it's all things like focus groups and interviews and case studies. There's almost no survey data. I mean, it's not quantitative at all. And now almost all social science is quantitative. And we can thank people who created the GSS and the American National Election Study, which goes back to 1948, by the way, and the Cooperative Election Study. There's all these data sources now that we have that have made it much, much easier to be a social scientist. Now, I don't have to leave my office to write a book about social science. I mean, there are people who get on a plane and go to Zimbabwe and live there for 2 years and have to learn the language to understand what's going on in Zimbabwe. I can sit at my computer, type some code, and write an entire book and never leave my office. I mean, that's an amazing thing just from a logistical standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we've had this statistical survey for years. It's basically the diagnostic and statistical manual for data nerds, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. The gold standard, as you've said. With this particular survey that we're talking about that includes this category of the Nuns, N-O-N-E-S, that came up in the book club discussion, not the Nuns like the Catholic Sisters, but the N-O-N-E-S. This is particularly focused on religion, the practice of religion in America. And how can you break down sort of the evolution of how this has come to be. So, for example, how many people on average, how does this survey particularly work, this particular religious survey? How many people do they contact? How do they contact people? Is it just ticking blocks on a piece of paper, or do people come in to Chicago for interviews? How do they do this, Ryan?
So it is So it was face to face before COVID. That's a whole different, that's actually a chapter in the Nuns version 2 about how they had to shift everything because of COVID and go online.
Okay.
You know, for 50 years, it's been a face to face survey. They would mail something to you in a random way. And then they would, if you accepted the invitation, then they would give you a place to meet them at, and they would interview you face to face. The interview would last, I mean, an hour and a half to 2 hours, and you would get compensated for that.
Wow.
I don't know what the because there's no way you're going to get people to actually show up unless you pay them.
Right.
I mean, and if you did, if you didn't pay them, you would get people, like, you wouldn't get doctors, you know, you wouldn't get lawyers.
Right.
Because their time is more valuable than that. So you've got to find ways to offset these problems they have. And so they would invite you to come in, and they would do this long survey, and there were like cards they would hand you, like, of these five options, which one do you like, and things like that. So it was all done face to face. The average sample was between 2,500 and 3,000, which is a pretty good sample in historical terms. And then they would do all kinds of weighting on the back end to make sure it matched, you know, demographics in terms of, you know, age, race, gender, education, all those kind of things that we want. Now, in 2021, the problem was we had COVID. So you can't do a face-to-face survey in the middle of a pandemic. And so they actually went to an online method in 2020 and 2021, and the data came out, and it's an absolute disaster. Like, we're seeing the share of Americans who are Protestant drop like 8 points in 3 years. And that's just not statistically accurate. Like, that religion doesn't change that fast. It never has, it never will. And the reason is because it's a mode effect. We call that a survey mode effect. If you ask someone face to face a question, they're going to answer it differently than if you put it on a web browser and walk out of the room, because they're not going to look at you. And I talk about this in the book, social desirability bias is the term that we use, the academic term, which is just a fancy way of saying people lie on surveys. I mean, you know, there's certain areas where they lie a lot about. Drug use is one, obviously, infidelity, anything sexual, right? Masturbation, how many partners we had, anything like that, they're going to lie about. Volunteerism, but also religion. People lie about religion a lot. And so, you know, the question here is, when we move that survey from face-to-face to online, are we getting closer to the real answer because people are more likely to be honest about their religion when they're looking at a web browser? But the other problem with that, though, is, too, a lot of people don't know what religion they are. And so if they did it face to face, the interviewer would kind of help nudge them in the right direction. You know, if they said, like, are you Protestant, Catholic, Muslim, or none? And you said, well, I'm Baptist. The survey interviewer would go, oh, wait, OK, I'll check the Protestant box for you. And then you'll get the Baptist option after that. On an online survey, you don't have that help. I mean, you got to know what you are. So the question is, it's a moving target. Is it people not knowing? Is it people lying? You know, there's all these issues that come on when you change survey mode effect. So in the book, I spend like a whole chapter talking about how like the GSS data is all messed up now because we went to online distribution. So the question is, in 2023, do they go back to a face-to-face or do they go stay online? You know, what's the right answer in that situation? I don't know the answer yet. And it's going to change how we think about the world around us and how we do social science. I don't think people realize like this is like the ground shifting underneath us. It's like concrete cracking under our feet. And we don't know how to, we've never faced this problem before, so yeah. We don't know how to fix it.
Let me ask you, Ryan, do you think in terms of the latest shift that occurred online, when people are going online, not only do we have this pandemic going on, but of course, the world is familiar with the whole idea of fake news, whatever that was. But I think what has also transpired, and something that may be working against the survey presently, is a sense of distrust. And this, I brought this up in our club meeting, where if you're asking me these very pointed questions about my religious background, in the era of fake news and Donald Trump and conspiracy theories and all of these other things, there also seems to be maybe a distrust on why are you wanting to be so particularly interested in what I believe. And so there's one more ingredient, it seems, that could be added to the moving unknown here, that people just want to avoid being identified so specifically. Do you think that's a factor? Could be?
I think that Trump, for all the things Trump did to America, I mean, everyone has their opinion about Trump, good, sure, bad, and indifferent. the one thing that I think he's really done for my world is he's made people distrustful of surveys much more so than they were 5 or 10 years ago. And I think that's problematic. You know, the whole idea of like a shy Trump voter. There are people who on, you would ask them on surveys before the 2016 election, who are you going to vote for? And they would say, well, I'm undecided, when they're really going to vote for Trump. And they just didn't want to say it. You know, they were afraid to tell people they're going to vote for Trump. But I think he's also killed, you know, and then the polls came out and it said, well, Hillary Clinton's going to win. And then Trump wins. And then everyone goes, well, the surveys are all junk. It's all propaganda. It's all designed to, you know, make Democrats look good and Republicans look bad. Well, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, Trump really is the one who spiked confidence in surveys. And that's what made him less accurate. Now, what's interesting about that is I just saw 538 did a big release. They like looked at the polls from 2022 to see how accurate they were. And they actually found they were probably the most accurate they've ever been in 2022. So statistically, they're better than they've ever been. But from a public, you know, opinion, a perception of surveys, people have less confidence in them now than they've ever had. So it's this weird here's what I say to people. I go, do you think the world will be better if we didn't do surveys? Because I cannot, in my mind, find a pathway to think that where I really think it's true that we should just make all surveys illegal in this country. We would know much less about America if we did that. Now, are they perfect? Absolutely not. Are they inaccurate sometimes? Absolutely. Do people misrepresent themselves on surveys? They absolutely do. But and there, by the way, there are people working on this all the time. There's the American Academy of Public Opinion Researchers. This is their entire job, is to make these surveys better. And so I think that we have no other option. We need surveys. I mean, otherwise we're going to get a Dewey defeats Truman situation in every election because we have no idea what the outcome is going to be.
We'll have a bunch of newspapers that'll be worth something in 50 years.
Well, maybe that's good for the newspapers.
Yeah, it might be. Right. But I did wanted to ask you, Ryan, the whole book, and I brought this up in our conversation as well, and it engendered some lively back and forth. Do you think, in your expertise as a social scientist, how do you think that survey taking, maybe we call it a technology of some kind, an intellectual kind of technology, a way of knowing, that survey taking and data collecting and the way we process this and interpret this, how do you think the science of survey taking has impacted how we as a culture understand religion?
That's a great question. I think it, so here's where I find the most joy in doing what I do as a social scientist. I love talking to groups of people. Like, I love making my research palatable to the general audience. And here's what I love the most about that. When I can tell people they're not alone, like that is something I think is so incredibly powerful from both a social science perspective, but also just like a pastoral perspective. When people go, oh, so that's why this is like that. And this is why I feel like I don't fit in. And I think that's really like the value of surveys is no one has an objective view of reality. Like, they don't have an objective view of what America looks like or what real America looks like or whatever. You know, we all run in bubbles, whether it be, you know, a New York City bubble or a Midwest bubble or a white bubble or a Christian bubble or whatever it is. What social science says is like, listen, the world's bigger than your bubble. And there's all these other bubbles running around that you don't have any concept of. And I'm going to give you as close as we can an objective measure of what the world looks like. And I think that is what people need now more than ever, is they need people to get out of their bubbles and see the big picture and understand, like, all these groups are like, why don't you talk about me more? Because like, you're like 0.01% of America, dude. Like, not that you don't matter, but like, here's something that blows people's mind, especially on the left. Most Americans are still Christians. 53% of Americans are still Christians right now. I mean, that's a fact. Like, whether you like it or not, that's a fact. There's all these facts, like presents like 1% of Americans are Mormons. I mean, there's all these facts I can give you right now that help you situate yourself and help you explain the world around you. And I think that is how, I think that is what people are more in tune to when it comes to surveys, is helping them put themselves in social space. And I think it's my job to kind of help put those pieces in the right spot.
So there is, but you would suggest maybe that this, the way about providing this knowledge, it does seem to be a kind of a trade-off, maybe a both and, where you give us this as possible, as closely as possible, some kind of objective snapshot of the religious landscape. But then most people, let's say, who are even Christians, are sort of imbibing this idea about religion from the survey produced by the University of Chicago. And so yeah. My understanding of my faith is now sort of being more, because you make a point of this, I think, a little bit in the beginning of the book, about, to me, I see a lot of times, and my pastor doesn't do this, but it does exist in evangelicalism, where we sort of weaponize the statistic to prove a theological point or a non-theological point. And it seems that more and more our knowledge of our own faith is becoming less and less, and I'm in the field of apologetics, and I find this to be an issue in a different way, where we're more reliant upon the experts who interpret for us rather than the scriptures themselves. And so maybe the broader evangelical who listens to conservative talk radio will be more prone to identify himself statistically with these groups produced by the GSS rather than their own, the community, the tradition in the community and the scripture and the doctrine of Christianity. Is that too much of a reach to suggest that this might be happening, or do you think that's just, what do you think?
Let's take that down a rabbit trail just for a sec. So I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times last year. In the title, I can't think of something like how the word evangelical has become synonymous with the word Republican.
Yeah, right.
And I don't think people fully realize what's going on in the data. We ask everyone on surveys, do you identify as an evangelical Christian, evangelical/born-again Christian or not? It's a yes, no question. Everyone gets it. Whether you say you're Jewish or atheist or Protestant or whatever, you get the question. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing the share of Americans who self-identify as evangelical stayed exactly the same over the last 13 years, from 2008 to 2021. Exactly about a third of Americans say they're evangelical or born again. But here's what's fascinating. A couple things about that. One, the share of evangelicals who attend church seldom or never was 16% in 2008, and now it's 27% of evangelicals attend seldom or never.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So we're seeing a rise of non-attending evangelicals, but here's where it gets even weirder. We're seeing a rise in people who self-identify as evangelical who also identify as Muslim or Jewish.
Wow.
Or Mormon.
Wow.
Or Catholic. Yeah. And it always happens amongst Republicans, like much, much more likely. For instance, amongst Muslims, nearly 40% of Republican Muslims say they're evangelical or born again. It's only 10% of Democrat Muslims. So the word evangelical has become a political and cultural marker.
Yes.
Where people are grabbing onto it, not for apologetics reasons about, you know, Jesus and the death and resurrection and sanctification and all those things. They're grabbing onto it because I think what the word means is I'm conservative, not just theologically, but politically, culturally, socially. So they don't know what the word means from like a theological perspective. They only know what the word means from a cultural perspective. And you can actually look in like Twitter data. If you look at, I wrote a book chapter once where I looked at tweets that contained the word evangelical in them. And I did like a bunch of grabs over like an 18-month period of time. And of those tweets, the share of the evangelical tweets that contain the word Trump nearly doubled over an 18-month period of time. So at least in the Twittering public, which is not the general public, but the Twittering public, we're seeing that linkage between evangelical and Trump or GOP or MAGA become stronger and stronger over time. So that word is not even really, I argue, I don't even think it's a religious word anymore. I think people primarily see it as a cultural or a political word.
I would tend to agree with you from what I've seen that it has gone the opposite extreme from, you know, evangelion, the Greek word for good news, to sort of this association with Trump and fake news. So how strange that is, that good news has become sort of associated with fake news. But mm-hmm. I agree with you. I think that tends to be the case where you hear the word evangelical and it's more political. It's more associated with conservative politicalism. Or that word is heard and people don't understand its theological roots. That is fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I think, so do you think that, to what do we attribute that, do you think, Ryan? Where does that that ignorance or that shift, what do you see as a social scientist? What can we blame for that? What do you think?
Well, first of all, I gotta say to people, I don't own words and neither do you. You know, no one owns the word evangelical. It means what the public think it means, right? So people are like, no, you can't. People get so mad at me. No, you can't be an evangelical Muslim. I go, why not? Like, who says, you know, like the word does not belong to like traditional, like Billy Graham, evangelical Christians. I think it's politics has infected every part of American life. Mm. I think politics is really like the primary lens And actually, the social science is coming around to this conclusion. It used to be we thought that like religion was the first lens on your eye and everything was downstream of that. So you looked at politics through a religious lens. Now, in the last 10, 15 years or so, the data has gotten better on this. And I think culture has also shifted. We're understanding now that politics is the first lens and religion is now downstream of politics. So we're picking our churches based on our political persuasions. We're not picking our parties based on our religious backgrounds.
Wow.
And I think that is where the word evangelical sort of evolved, is because everything is political now and every word is political and every group is political. And so when you think about the world that way, then the word evangelical is not about the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's about we vote for Donald Trump.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that we have a similar paradigm shift in our understanding of, I might even put the lens of science before politics. We might go science, then politics, then our faith. And I just did a book interview with a philosopher of science, Paul Tyson, from Australia. And Paul has a book about the theology of science. It just came out. And his argument is that as a culture, we tend to, well, we have abdicated to a sort of enlightenment understanding of everything about us. In other words, that we are now a culture that defines itself. If there's any truth to be found about human beings, it can only first and foremost come through the sciences. And this is not to denigrate scientific knowledge of who we are, but it is to show that there are limits of the scientific enterprise. And this leads me to a wonderful quote you have in the book. And we this was a hit in the book club when we talked about it. Let me see if I can find it here. Yeah, chapter 2, a social scientist tries to explain religious disaffiliation. And your quote brought up this idea of the idea of science trying to interpret things. You say the problem with social science is that it's the study of people. People are emotional, unpredictable, and completely unintelligible most of the time. And the couple of skeptics really like that quote because it's really hard to... finally, what does it mean to understand something through the social sciences? How are we understanding these people? How are we to basically understand that? Do you think in the survey taking, Ryan, and I'm not denigrating the information that comes from these surveys, but how does the social scientist account for this variability and unreliability, if you will, of human behavior, as you annotate in the book here?
Oh, man. I mean, when in grad school, everyone has like a crisis about this question where you go like, do we know anything? Like we had a guy in grad school and all of us like went through that phase and it lasted like a year where we're like, we don't know anything about the world. Surveys are all, you know, like if you ask the same question to the same people 10 times, you're going to get 10 different answers. And you know, you go through this like moment of like, I don't know anything. And then there's like this one guy who always like never gives up that opinion and continues to talk about it like in year four. And you're like, okay, dude, we're like past that now. Like I cannot live in that world anymore, because then it means everything that we've built upon that foundation is now false, which I don't think is true. I think there's actually a lot of things that we know. So there's a book called The Nature and Origin of Mass Opinion by John Zoller. It came out like in 1990. And he... your audience, please don't read that book. It's like so dense and boring. I'll just like summarize it for you, honestly. John Zoller says that everything, when you do surveys, you're getting top of the head knowledge. So like whatever you were thinking about that morning is going to flavor how you answer that survey. And so that's why if you ask people the same question 5 days in a row, you're going to get five different answers based on what's on the top of the head. So if you do surveys right after like a major historic event, you're going to get these weird answers because top of the head is going to be like, well, Ukraine just got invaded by Russia, or we just got attacked on 9/11, or January 6th, or you pick, right? So the problem is we don't have, a lot of people are very suggestible on surveys. So you know, even things like what order you ask questions in can change how people answer the questions. Let me cut through all that stuff though. If you look at the General Social Survey, which has been going on since 1972, which we just talked about. If you calculate the mean political ideology of people from 1972 to 2021, that number is statistically the same today as it was in 1972. So somehow, some way, there's something called the wisdom of crowds. Like one person can be way wrong, but 1,000 people typically can get you close to the right answer. And I think that's how surveys work is, you know, if you look at one survey, you get weird results. If you look at 10 surveys, the results start becoming a lot more consistent and we have a lot more confidence in the results. And I think that's where we are now because we've been doing this for so long. We've gotten a lot better at it and a lot more sophisticated at it. So I think that's why I have more confidence. The other part is I have to. I can't do this job unless I believe in what I'm doing. And I think the preponderance of evidence tells me that I have a reasonable degree of confidence in surveys. Which, by the way, if you really want to get down to it, even people who do like hard sciences, like medical studies and things like that, they only have a reasonable amount of confidence in their results too. They just don't tell you that. I'm more willing to tell you that. Like the studies on masking are not nearly as good as you think they are. If you really look at the data, there, you know, I think generally the presupposition is you should wear masks in confined spaces if you're sick, things like that. But in a general population survey, it's almost impossible to mask in a proper way and do an analysis in a proper way because no one really follows the rules. So the same thing happens in surveys. It's as best as we can do with what we have, and we kind of have to shake our heads and go, well, this is as good as it gets, at least for now, and then go on living in that veil, like that veil of ignorance in some ways of like it could be better, but this is as good as it gets for now, especially.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe to the Apologetics Profile podcast. You can also support the podcast by becoming a patron at patreon.com/Watchman Fellowship today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Apologetics Profile. I'm Dave Mitchell.